Our thanks to Dr. Jacques Vallée for being here to outline his proposal for a new global database to try to get to the bottom of the UFO mystery. We're going to hear about, get a reaction to that from Lee Spiegel, who is a journalist who's been working on the covering UFOs since the 1970s, was part of a proposal with Jacques Vallée to get a study underway with the United Nations, and has a unique insight into this plan and the big picture of UFO mysteries. Going to jump right into that right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Lee Spiegel is a writer, reporter, and media personality. He worked for several years with ABC News, was with NBC Radio, where he produced about 1,500 programs on unexplained phenomena. He's currently writing for the Huffington Post, and as I mentioned at the top of the program, as a key speaker, went over big with the audience at the MUFON Symposium last weekend. Welcome back to the show, Lee Spiegel. Lee, good to have you here.
Well, thank you very much. And hey, right back at you. You were the keynote speaker at last weekend's event, and I believe you probably got the biggest standing ovation of the weekend.
You're making me blush, Lee.
I can sense that. Oh, by the way, George, thank you so much for the great opening act of Jacques Vallée.
Yeah. Hey, what do you, let's get your take on that, the proposal. I mean, it's ambitious. It sounds like he's not going to wait for any sponsor or government to help him out. He's starting to work on it. First of all, would it work, do you think, and is it worth pursuing?
Well, you know, I'm sure you understand also, when you listen to a man talk like Jacques Vallée, when he talks about UFOs, you can't help but understand that he does the legwork on this subject and always has, probably better than anyone. There are so many people out there who don't use the scientific method of explaining what the truly unknown objects are that people have reported. But Jacques is the real deal, and he always has been. And it's like when Jacques Vallée talks, people listen. Because he is a scientist, there are so many non-scientists out there who are just kind of futzing around and trying to do their thing. And as Jacques was saying to you, you know, we're still at a point where the UFO organizations, especially in America, always at each other's throats. When I first got involved in the subject back in the 1970s, there were more of these organizations besides the MUFON. There was NICAP, the Center for UFO Studies, another one called APRO. And the attitude was, we're not going to share any of our information with you. We don't have to. It's almost like, how many military organizations out there would be willing to share what they have, technology that they have, with other military organizations? Nobody wants to. But a guy like Jacques Vallée, who wants to continue using the scientific approach, is exactly what this is, what's needed here. I agree so much with his attitude of how there are more questions now than there are answers. So many questions about the phenomenon that have evolved over the years. We really don't know the answers. And I like the idea where he says that there's a whole new generation of scientists who are facing new issues dealing with UFOs or UAP, as he likes to refer to them. I like what the whole idea that Jacques wants to really continue to research many of the UFO reports before the Industrial Revolution, before, as he said, there were dirigibles or planes and anything else that flew in the sky. So as long as we have people like him who want to do the work and do it with credibility and integrity, then I think we have a chance. And you know what, George? You and I agree on this as well. I don't really believe there's going to be disclosure like everybody's talking about. I remember when I started working to prepare for this 1978 presentation at the United Nations that Jacques worked on with me, I remember thinking, wow, you know, this is going to be something that people are going to talk about for many years, and maybe the government will really finally let loose on some information. Maybe the other governments will if we do it at the United Nations. I wasn't even using the word disclosure back then, but now that I look back on it, I realize it was one of the first attempts at disclosure, But now here I am almost 40 years later thinking, I don't think disclosure will happen because it's not really up to us. It's not up to our government. It's not up to the United Nations. I basically put it into the hands and the responsibility of the visitors themselves. It's up to them. If they want to disclose themselves, go ahead and do it. So I have a problem with the whole disclosure concept.
Well, we'll come back to that. I would definitely come back to the United Nations stuff because I want to hear that story. But what, as you mentioned, the new generation, the comment that Jacques had made, there's a new generation, he said, in particular, there are different attitudes among scientists outside of America toward the topic. The problem is that as a new generation that might be willing to study this stuff, but they don't have the institutional knowledge of somebody like a Stan Friedman or Jacques Vallée, those voices, once they're gone for good.
Well, yes. And not only do they not have the institutional knowledge, but in a lot of cases, they don't have the institutional funding to really pursue this professionally if they want to. That's always been a problem for scientists who've been interested in UFOs or who wanted to study it, to try and get their universities to provide them with funding or to try and get funding from the government. It could never happen. It would be a career killer even to admit that you wanted to study this. So that is a problem. I think it's going to have to take a very dedicated new group of young scientists who can approach this with an open mind and also keep it out of the hands of government. You know, quite honestly, I really don't think the governments of the world know what's going on. It took me a while to get to this point, but I do believe that now, and it's a little frustrating, but I think that this new generation of scientists will at least begin to pick away at this information. I have begged Stan Friedman to get as healthy as he can and to never leave us, because we need a person who has that dogged personality to go out there and do the work and get the facts.
Let's talk about this idea for sort of a global database. You mentioned about how even back when you started that the rival organizations would not cooperate, APRO, NICAP, all those groups. Do you think that that's different? Would you anticipate that if Jacques Vallée proposed this to CUFOs, MUFON, that they would join forces and put all their stuff in a giant database, or is there still a turf war going on?
I think there is a turf war ongoing. I don't know if as popular and credible as Jacques is, and everybody knows him and respects him, just the fact that he would ask people to pool their resources together and come together and try and unlock more of the answers to this mystery, I don't think they necessarily want to do it. They can put on a good front and say, oh, yes, we want to cooperate with everyone. But in the end, sometimes I don't know if the organizations are any different than the military. And I know some people will get annoyed to hear me say something like that. But when you think about it, like I said before, no military strategist or organization wants to share information. They want to keep it for themselves. And I've seen the same attitude with UFO organizations. It's our case. It's our pictures. It's our video. We don't really need to share it with anybody, so why should we? We'll let you have the information when we want. We don't want to give out the names of the witnesses. They prefer to stay anonymous. We think it's right. We'll publish it when we feel the time is right. And I sit here thinking, well, what's the point of this? It's like there is no point. It's almost like school children playing games. And I'm not going to name names. I'm not going to name organizations. I'm just saying that I see this happening, but it's nothing new. We need new strategies. What we need, George, is something dramatic to happen, I've always said.
An incident, something that can't be explained away, the proverbial White House lawn landing.
I always love that. If you take 10 people and line them up and start at one end of the line and go from one person to another and say to them, what would it take you to believe that somebody is visiting Earth from somewhere else? you will get 10 different answers. One of them might be, I'd like one to land on the White House lawn. Another one would say, well, I'd like one to land at the Kremlin. Another person will say, I think they should just appear over every major city. Someone else would say, I think the president should make an announcement. I think the United Nations should make an announcement. I'd like to have my own encounter. You get all these very good, valid possibilities, but are any of them any better than any others? I still think, I maintain, that we are not in control of something like that. When I say something dramatic has to happen, really, I think the visitors, if they want to, if they care, and as Jacques said to you before, they have their own agenda, and they probably don't care that much about what's going on planet Earth, but we don't know for sure. With their own agenda, we just don't know. But we do need something dramatic that can bring people together, that could affect the planet. I think that a nice place for something dramatic to happen, be nice if it came out of the Vatican. Because when the Vatican talks, when the Pope talks, like when Pope Francis made his little announcement a couple of months ago during a morning service in Italy, and he actually just came out and said, you know, what if Martians were to land? Would we be interested in baptizing any of them if they wanted? And he said, well, why not?
Let's talk about that for a second, because Jacques yeah. mentioned it. You know, he said, well, the Catholics have been talking about the ramifications of this for a couple of hundred years.
Yeah.
This Pope, I don't know if you've written about this, Lee, but this Pope is sort of different. I mean, he doesn't seem to play by the same rule book that the previous popes. I mean, he said some pretty interesting things, made some interesting decisions. I mean, if anybody was going to make an announcement, it might be this guy.
Well, I think you're right, and I'm not suggesting that he's on the verge of that, but right. but by throwing out little hints like that, I mean, basically, he was teasing people because he knows everything that he says in public instantly goes viral because it's the Pope. So you'd have to assume that he has advisors that are suggesting what he says and doesn't say. Did he come up with this Martians getting baptized all by himself, or did he have a network of people saying, you know, Francis, this morning when you're out there in front of the throng, why don't you throw this out and see what happens? See what kind of reaction you get. And it did go viral. I mean, it went everywhere. Pope Francis says, you know, Martians could be baptized if they so desired. And that's not the first time that we've heard that kind of statement from someone from the Vatican. Many people, whenever I talk to people about this, I'm surprised to discover how many people don't know that the Vatican has two separate, fully functional astronomical observatories, right. one in Arizona and one in Italy. And they're run by Jesuit priests. And my question always is, what are they looking for? Why are they so interested in the cosmos? Well, they're looking for life in outer space, says Reverend Ted Peters, who's very outspoken. I think he's a Presbyterian or maybe no, a Lutheran minister. He's out there, and he's doing a lot of good work, trying to get people to come together to understand that. I think he once actually told me that people would actually be very comfortable with sharing a pew in a church with aliens.
Yeah.
I love that.
I mean, I remember when I first started working on this, going around and surveying the leaders of different faiths, the Mormons, yeah. Baptists, and Catholics, mm-hmm. and all of them had sort of the same approach, is that it doesn't bother us. It's more souls to save, you know, more alien shekels in the collection plate on Sunday or something like that. Let me ask you this, Lee. While Jacques is on, a man with his credentials, he's yeah. been boots on the ground for close to 50 years investigating yep. UFO cases. He thinks that there is proof that something really is going on, physical proof. Trace cases affect, you know, the impact on bugs and soil and people, lights in the sky, photographs. There's a lot of evidence out there. And yet, even with somebody like him who has found it himself, I'm getting emails during the interview. It's all a bunch of baloney. There is no evidence. It's not just people not willing to look at what exists. It's an overt hostility and unwillingness to take a look at it. What do you deal? How do you deal with that attitude in your own work? Because you must get a lot of response in writing for Huffington Post that this is all a waste of your time.
I do. I get emails and comments every day from people who are out there saying, "What evidence? There's no evidence. You're part of the disinformation of bad news that the Huffington Post is telling you to write about. You probably have no concept of what you want to write about. You're told by Arianna Huffington herself what kind of stories you can do. You have to go through an editorial process because they want to make sure that you can or cannot say certain things." And that's just, it's just a load of crap. But I get this all the time. There is a hostility element out there for people who just simply don't want to believe. And what I say to, sometimes I'll say to individuals who come across really difficult like that, I'll ask them questions. I'll say, "Have you personally spent any time investigating any UFO cases?" And I don't mean just listening to a UFO report occasionally on the 11 o'clock news or reading one or two books or a magazine article. Have you gone out there and done some investigation? Have you talked with eyewitnesses? Have you talked with any airline pilots? Have you talked with anyone in the military who has chased UFOs? Have you actually done some legwork to form a really good opinion? And, of course, the majority of the people will say to me, "Well, no, I haven't done that." And then my response is, "Well, then you don't have a valid opinion." So please don't be spouting off that there's no such thing out there unless you can back it up with some real work. And I don't think that's too much to ask of people.
No, I agree with you. I'm not surprised that you get a lot of reaction because I get it too. And I don't write for a national media organization as you do. I don't quite understand the overt hostility, but it clearly, even after all these years, all the movies and books and TV shows, it is still represents some kind of a threat to some people to the point where they don't want to hear it.
It's amazing. If you sit down and talk to any of the scientists, the astronomers at the SETI Institute, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, they're very nice people. I like many of them. I'm friends with Seth Shostak, the senior astronomer. 15 years ago, I did a project, a national radio show about classical music, and I was the producer of it. And I came up with an idea to do something called the Classics in Outer Space. And it was based on the idea that on both Voyager spacecraft that we launched in the late 1970s, scientists put two phonograph recording record players on both spacecraft, gold-plated, with two gold-plated records. And on the record, if any alien intelligence could discover these things in deep space, they would be able to figure out how to play the recording, and it would have the voices, the sounds, and pictures of planet Earth and what was going on with planet Earth in the 1970s. And so for this radio show, Frank Drake, the creator of SETI, was the co-host for the show. So we get to spend some time with each other. And one day, he and I were alone in an office room.
Lee, I'm going to have to interrupt you there. I'm sorry. We'll continue this story on the other side, the story with Frank Drake. Can't wait to hear what he has to say. We're talking with Lee Spiegel of Huffington Post. If you are with us in the first half of tonight's program, you heard Dr. Jacques Vallée propose the creation of a global database on UFOs, one that would incorporate 200,000 or so cases that have been accumulated by civilian and military organizations and governments over the years, which might allow scientists all over the planet to look for patterns and finally get some answers about those big questions about UFOs that have never been answered. Lee Spiegel is our guest. He's from the Huffington Post, telling us, and he's going to give us a reaction to the proposal by Vallée, and tell us why a similar proposal to do a study at the United Nations was torpedoed. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Lee Spiegel, before the break, you were telling us a story about attitudes among some of the SETI folks toward the UFO topic. Please continue.
I was working on a nationally syndicated classical music show called, this particular segment was The Classics in Outer Space. And the idea that I came up with was, why don't we do an entire program about the classical music, famous pieces of classical music that were included in the two Voyager spacecraft that are now going out into deep space, so that at some point in the distant future, if some alien civilization were to intercept either or both of these spacecraft, they would hear what some of the music was on planet Earth in the 1970s. Helping me with this project and the co-host of the show was Dr. Frank Drake, the man who created and gave us the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, the SETI Institute. And he and I had several chances to talk and have some conversations about things like SETI and the search for alien signals. And one day we were alone, and I said to him, Frank, I have to ask you. Now, I respect you, respect what you've done using radio telescopes to try and find that needle in a haystack audio signal from somewhere. How would you respond to the fact that there are credible, reliable people, including airline pilots, law enforcement individuals, military pilots, who basically are saying there are objects that are landing in people's backyards, you know, of unknown origin? How do we get around that from the SETI Institute point of view? And he said, well, I'm aware of those reports, certainly, but no one has ever shown me any kind of real tangible evidence that would indicate to me that we're being visited by anyone from anywhere else. And I said, does that include the fact that there have been not only reliable witnesses who have seen these things, but there have been many photographs and films through the years that were not hoaxes, even though with the internet now and YouTube, it's so much easier to hoax something. But in the past, before the advent of the internet, there were hoaxes, of course, but there was also a percentage of things that were the real deal, or at least something that wasn't a hoax. And he said, nope, I'm still not convinced that we're being visited. You have to show me some kind of like real proof. And I said, well, what would it take, Frank? What would it take to like hit you over the head? Would you have to have your own experience? And he said, well, that might help. And that's part of the attitude, George, with many scientists. I said before, I like many of the scientists at SETI, and I've interviewed Seth Shostak, a senior astronomer there, many times. I just wrote a story about a few weeks ago featuring Seth talking about how now they believe that we will find absolute evidence of extraterrestrial life. Now, they're not going any further than it might be microbial. You know, we don't know if it's intelligent life, but they believe that with all the information coming back to us from the lovely little Kepler spacecraft that's been uncovering lots and lots of planets, and many of them, they say, are habitable. But again, habitable by whom or by what? You always have to qualify that kind of stuff. But Seth Shostak says, while there are no true UFOs that appear to be coming from outer space, we're very close to finding that needle in a haystack. Give us another 20 years with better technology, and we'll find it. Well, okay. And then if you try and get them to talk more about UFOs, they don't want to go any further than that. They shut down. They will not talk about it other than to say, there's nothing to it. We're doing the real science. Well, you know, that's the thing that you and I were talking about. It's the same thing with all the jealousies, I think, between the UFO organizations, between military organizations. One form of scientific attitude is opposed to someone else. I would say for every five scientists or astronomers who will say to you there's no evidence of any visitation going on now, with enough digging, I could find maybe an equal number of astronomers and scientists with the equal credentials who would say, no, I think there's some evidence we should be studying it. Because I started to find some of these people. I've had scientists, George, come up to me after some of my presentations, giving me their business card. You know, I'm so-and-so from the University of so-and-so. I'm an astronomer, and I liked your presentation. I actually think that we're being visited, but I'm afraid to talk about it because it could be a career killer.
Sure.
There's the problem, you know?
You know, with SETI, I don't see that the SETI approach and the study of UFOs are mutually exclusive. You could do both, except for the fact that I think it may be as simple as this, that UFOs, if taken seriously by scientists, it becomes a lot less sexy to pursue something like SETI. If they're already here, why are we looking for radio signals out there? I think it might be they're worried about the next paycheck.
And the other part of this is, George, is let's say tomorrow one of our radio telescopes, or the big dish, the Arecibo dish in Puerto Rico, let's say it picks up a legitimate intelligent signal, you know, something that through mathematics and the language of science basically says, hi, we're here, we're out there. Well, then the problem becomes, well, if we figure out how to respond with our own hi, how long is it going to take for our response to get to them, assuming they're still alive, those who sent the signal in the first place? And what kind of a meaningful conversation could we have with anybody under these technological circumstances?
Are you sure you want to send that message, too, that says, hey, come and visit us?
No, Professor Stephen Hawking actually warned that we should not be trying to contact someone from outer space. He said, basically, look at how badly it turned out for the Native Americans when Columbus arrived.
Let's talk about Jacques' plan in the context of the United Nations event that you were involved with. You know, he's proposing this global database, have a study, everybody has access to information. Back in the late 70s, and we've posted some photos of this effort on the Coast to Coast website, back in the late 70s, you were involved in planning. It would seem like the United Nations would be a good place to park a study like that, to house a study like that. So tell us the story of what you hope to do and how it went.
Well, in 1977, I started noticing that the Prime Minister of Grenada, Eric Gehry, was starting to make some speeches at the United Nations about how he had had some UFO encounters in his own country, and that he believed that Grenada was a hot spot of UFOs, and that he was hoping that the nations of the world might want to think about forming a committee where they could actually share information between the various nations and the scientists of the nations about UFOs. Because one of the big problems that I think you and Jacques talked about, the translation problems are enormous to try and take cases, UFO cases from around the world. Some of them are so richly detailed, and to try and translate them all to then send them all to the various other countries for their own analysis, it's a huge undertaking. But if you're going to do it, you have to do it that way so that everybody can read it and understand it and discuss it. So I noticed that the UN was basically not paying any attention to Eric Gehry. He has the any leader of any country can go in front of the General Assembly and do a speech about whatever it is they would like to propose and to get it voted on. His crusade was UFOs in 1977, but nobody cared. And I thought, boy, you know, if I could do something at the United Nations. But I discovered you can't just walk up to the door of the UN and knock on the door and say, hi, Can I do a UFO presentation here, please? I mean, how fast will I be locked up? Because all that I had done in the field up until that point was, in 1975, I produced a documentary vinyl record album called UFOs, The Credibility Factor.
Oh, I've got to find one of those. I've got to find one. But go ahead.
Well, Yeah, I'll tell you what, George. Right now, the best place you can find it is on eBay, because people who bought the album back in '75, they probably snatched up a few of them, and they're selling them on eBay.
I'll look.
But no, don't worry. I may be able to arrange for you to have one through other means.
So anyway, you pitched it to someone. Who'd you pitch it to?
CBS. Yeah, I got together. I got friendly with an author. Ralph and Judy Blum wrote one of the better books in the 1970s called Beyond Earth: Man's Contact with UFOs. And it was a really good book in which Ralph had been doing some work for CBS, working on a CBS white paper report about UFOs. And he was in touch with the leading scientists at the time, astronauts, some political figures. And I read his book and thought, boy, you know, this is a great book. I would like to hear the voices of these people that I'm reading about. So I met the guy through nefarious ways, and got him to like me. And I said, look, I've got an idea of how we can take your book and maybe do something into and put, turn it into a recording and sell it. And through some connections he had, some that I was making, we ended up doing a presentation at CBS. This was at a time when CBS was doing nighttime, primetime television record sales on TV. They were doing 2-minute commercials, you know, the great hits of Mantovani, you know, for $9.95. And if you don't want the album, tell us and we'll send you the 8-track tape version. Do we all remember 8-track tapes? So we worked out a deal, and CBS went for the idea and agreed to let me do it, produce it. We would sell it in a 2-minute commercial, and that all happened. And so I had this product that was out there selling, and so that was the only thing that I had in my hands in 1977 when suddenly Eric Gehry was talking about UFOs at the UN. So I sent one of my albums. No, actually, I didn't send it. I went to the Grenada Mission in New York, got friendly with the ambassadors there, and said, would you please give this recording that I made to your prime minister with my compliments? And I would very much like to meet him sometime because I have an idea of how we could help each other with our individual passions and crusades about UFOs. Not long after that, I was invited to the UN on the night that Eric Gehry was knighted as Sir Eric Gehry. We met in a private room, and over a handshake deal, he agreed to have the country of Grenada sponsor my proposal to do a big UFO presentation at the UN. Because I said to him, Mr. Prime Minister, with all due respect, you've been pitching your idea at the UN, but they're not really paying attention to you. But if you sponsor something I want to do here, I will bring the people to the UN to speak who the countries will pay attention to, like J. Allen Hynek, Jacques Vallée, Claude Poher, Stanton Friedman, Gordon Cooper. I will bring all these people there. Captain Larry Coyne of the Army with the amazing helicopter incident that he almost collided into. I will bring these people to the UN. So they had to give me a delegate's card. I became a delegate of Grenada, and they started sending me money from the United Bank of Grenada to fund the work that I was going to do to get all this stuff together. And of course, that then led to me finding out later, through released documents through the Freedom of Information Act, that the State Department started keeping tabs on me. Well, of course that happened. You know, I mean, why wouldn't they consider me a person of interest?
Sure, they're an agent of Grenada.
Yeah. I mean, I loved my little delegate card. I didn't wear it everywhere, of course, but you know, it got me into a few places at the UN. And one of the pictures that I sent you—it's the lead picture on NAPS News right now—is a famous shot from July of that year, '78, that shows a bunch of us and my speakers and I and the Secretary General, Kurt Waldheim, all sitting around a big conference table, closed door meeting in which he wanted to know what was my plan? What was I going to present at the UN later that year? and basically spent the rest of the year putting all this stuff together, gathering documents and getting people ready. And I mean, just things like when I wanted to get Captain Larry Coyne to come to the UN to describe his amazingly credible encounter when he was the commander of a four-man helicopter in 1973 that almost collided with a UFO, and he wanted to come to the UN. He was one of the people that I interviewed for my UFO album in 1975. He said, "I'd love to come and talk to the UN, but you'll have to contact my commanding officer back in Ohio and get permission." And I said, "Well, is that going to be a big deal? Will I get any kind of resistance?" He said, "Well, I'm not sure, but here's the guy's name, here's his number, give him a call." And I did. I got the commanding officer on the phone, outlined my idea, and I said, is there any problem with having Captain Coyne come to New York to the United Nations to tell his story?" And the guy said to me, "Well, we will give him permission to do that on one condition." And I said, "Okay, what's that?" "We would prefer that he not show up there in uniform. He would have to come dressed in a civilian suit." And I said, "That's it? That's the condition? You're saying that I may have to buy the guy a suit, but you'll okay him coming to New York?" He said, "Yeah, that's really all we care about. He will not be there in an official capacity representing the United States Army, but we'll let him go there as long as he's in a regular business suit." And I said, "Geez, thanks, no problem."
Yeah.
And so the pictures that we have of Captain Coyne talking at the UN, he's not in uniform, he's in a regular suit. So many things that, you know, that happened. Working with Jacques Vallée, that was when I had a chance finally to meet him for the first time. Right after Grenada decided to let me do the presentation, and then Alan Hynek wrote me from the Center of UFO Studies and says, "Yes, now I want to get on board, because if you're doing the presentation, you know, I'll bring other people involved." And then one day I got a call from Columbia Pictures, who flew me from New York, Alan Hynek from Illinois, Jacques Vallée from Northern California. We were all flown in to Hollywood for a private meeting with Steven Spielberg.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. Oh, man. This was like 6 months after the premiere of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So people were still talking about the movie, what a big movie this was. Steven wanted to know if there was anything he could do to help with the upcoming presentation. Remember, Alan Hynek was the scientific consultant on the movie. Hynek came up with the phrase Close Encounters of the First, Second, and Third Kind. Hynek is in the movie at the end as in a cameo, playing himself as a scientist when the mothership comes down. And, of course, as you mentioned, Jacques Vallée became Claude Lacombe in the movie. So, I mean, George, I'm sitting there in Steven Spielberg's office with him and Jacques Vallée and Alan Hynek. And on the surface, I'm like very cool, very confident, but inside I was just dying. At who I was sitting with and talking to.
All right. Oh, so you get a foot in the door. You are a representative of Grenada. You put together a dream team of UFO speakers, but things don't turn out exactly the way you planned. And when we come back, we'll hear that part of the story. It gets pretty good.